Teach me about the Great Lakes. Teach me about the Great Lakes. Cha!
Welcome back to Teach Me About the Great Lakes, a twice monthly, I can't even pretend that's true, a periodic podcast in which I, a Great Lakes novice, ask people who are smarter and harder working than I am to teach me all about the Great Lakes. My name is Stuart Carlton, and I know just very recently how hot the tea is if you try to sip it too soon. But I don't know a lot about the Great Lakes. That's the point of this here show. This is a different kind of episode. This is a follow-up episode. I will get into that in just a minute. But first, let's introduce, we're going to call you panelists today. Or co-host, our panel of co-hosts. Starting off with Megan Lake Lover Gunn. Megan, how are you today?
I'm good, Stuart. The weather's been nice. I mean, it's not as nice today, but the weather's been nice. So I've been in a really good mood.
No, my feet are cold today. Yeah, we had baseball. I had a youth baseball practice on Monday. I was like, we're just having practice. Mm-hmm. And it was super fun, basically, until, well, I won't go over that in a public forum. We're also joined. So normally we have a guest. Today we have no guest. We have a second host. We have Titus Seilheimer. You know him as Dr. Fish, Titus Seilheimer from Wisconsin Sea Grant. Titus, how are you?
I am doing wonderful. Nice to see both of you and talk to you.
There it is. That's right. We can see each other. This is not a video show. Maybe we'll cut up some shorts, though. That's what I learned. I cut up my shorts for Ask Dr. Fish, and we got those on YouTube. So maybe we'll cut up some shorts here, and you can look at those. We'll see.
Is that a Bart Simpson reference?
kind of, right? Anyway, so here's the deal. We had the Lakeys, which is our annual award ceremony, as I call it, quite possibly not the least prestigious podcast, Great Lakes podcast awards that there are. And after the Lakeys, Titus started texting me just all of the time. So Titus is a two-time Lakey runner-up, but he didn't text me about that. The first thing he texted me about errors, about omissions, about things that we could have done better. And so after I pretended to ignore the first 23 of these texts, but they just kept coming.
Stuart, I couldn't help it. I was just listening to it, and I wanted you to have the experience of having me interact with you.
It's so good.
Sure, it was like a week later, 2 weeks later, but you know, I was just I got to let him know.
Yeah, no, that's good. But the funny thing is about the way this goes is I had already completely forgotten what we had said and talked about. So I'm like, I have no idea what you're saying. But so the first thing is, so we had a Great Lakes Animal of the Year. And Megan, I'm sure, remembers what the Great Lakes Animal of the Year was this year. Oh, it was the Roseate Spoonbill, naturally.
Yes, because it's beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah. But also nominated was this, I'm not going to even pronounce this right. Is it the Kiyi? The Kiyi? What was it, Titus?
That is the Kiyi.
The Kiyi.
Kiyi was also nominated, and apparently we instantly, after mentioning the Kiyi, started, which is maybe a type of Cisco or something, I don't even know. We then started talking about Cisco more generally and completely forgot about the Kiyi. And Titus, I guess, as a Dr. Fish, was deeply offended by this.
Sorry.
I mean, Megan, you brought it as a Kiyi, you know, this goofball fish. And then you know, anybody, like, everybody knows Cisco's. So I was excited. And then I was like, hey, where did the Kiyi talk go? Because I want to hear more about Kiyi.
Have you met us? We just easily derail on all the things.
It's like he's never listened before. So yeah, it's unsurprising. It's unsurprising that in the Lakeys, the thing that we were trying to give a potential Lakey to, we instantly forgot about. So Titus, I bet you know a little bit about Kiyi. Tell us about Kiyi. Is it a Cisco? Why? What's the deal with Kiyi?
Yeah, so Kiyi, you know, when we talk Cisco, like, Cisco is just a mess of a, it's a name, it's a Cisco itself. When you say Cisco, you know, I hear Coregonus artidi or irididae, which is other people might know as lake herring. But this kind of broad group, this multiple species group called deep water Ciscos, which are things like the bloater, or you might know that as a smoked chub when you're at the fish market. So Kiyi is one of those deep water Ciscos. So it's a Coregonus Kiyi, kind of a cousin to the whitefish, to the Cisco, to the lake herring, whatever you want to call them. But Kiyi is a neat kind of goofy looking fish with these big kind of Dumbo like fins. They're just huge. It's got these huge eyes. It's a neat fish that I don't think a lot of people have heard about.
No, I don't. Yeah, I don't.
Can people eat them?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. They're not really caught a lot. I think they would be good as a smoked fish, kind of like a bloater. So if you had them, they're fairly small though.
Okay.
Are they in the Great? Oh yeah. Here I'm looking at a picture of them. They do have these big, their dorsal fin sticks up, and then they're, oh boy, not the pectoral fin, but the one is not, what is that one?
Pelvic fin.
Thank you, Titus. Oh my God. And I have a master's degree in fisheries biology. It's been a minute though. So their pelvic fin is really big too. So are these found throughout the Great Lakes? What is the deal with them?
Yeah, I mean, originally they were Lake Superior, Michigan, Huron, and Ontario. That was kind of their original distribution. Okay. But now, if you want to see Kaya, you got to go to Lake Superior. It's the only place that they're left in the Great Lakes. Although they are very abundant, or fairly abundant up there. So doing well, but not doing well in other lakes.
Why did their populations decimate in the other lakes?
I think it's the kind of the same story of a lot of our Great Lakes species. There was kind of this, unregulated fishing. They were harvested a lot, and there was actually, so the name Kaiai is actually the name that Lake Michigan commercial fishermen gave this fish back in the day. So when Kelts was this scientist guy surveying all the Ciscos back in the 20s or the teens, and this was the name that they were kind of known by over here in Lake Michigan. Hey, we caught some Kaiai. And I've heard that the name, somebody was looking into the name. They were like, what is the origin? Like, that's what they know, that mm-hmm. it was, this name that was used by the fishermen in Lake Michigan. And the only kind of reference to Kaya elsewhere is it's this, in the Navy, it's this brush that they use to like clean their clothes. Huh. So maybe a connection there from people who were in the Navy. And then this is a small fish. So kind of an interesting,
I just figured we had bastardized some sort of indigenous or Native American name, but no, maybe it's a Navy thing.
Right. Right. Well, and of course,
these fish to brush their clothes. That would be weird, but I mean, who knows?
I mean, you could do it.
You could. right before a hot date. That's what I like to really start rubbing the fish on.
the natural kind of glitter of the scales. Yeah,
that's so gross. Oh. Yeah. It's the prettiest though, right? It's the prettiest thing.
It is.
Yeah. So interesting. So you say that they're cousins. We can get a little nerdier than that on this show. So cousins are they share a family? Is it a genus? What kind of cousins are they? Are they kissing cousins, if you know what I'm getting at?
Yeah, I think they are. Actually, they're all Coregonus genus. And really this group of deep water ciscos are all, pretty closely related. Have differentiated into different species since the last ice age. So, over the last 20,000 years or so. And actually the Lake Huron Kaiai have probably just hybridized too much with, maybe the bloaters over there. They're, all the same genus there. Yeah, within the scientific kind of Great Lakes naming of fish community, in the last couple of years, a lot of argument about, are these different species? Are they just all Cisco, like Artidae, that are just, not genetically different? And it seems like the consensus now is they are different species. So
cool. Where do you fall on that in terms of lumping and splitting? Because, so when I was, I studied under taxonomists back in college and in my first run of graduate school. And I think then I was much more of a splitter. Now I tend to be much more of a lumper. Where do you fall? And why does it matter, I guess, whether or not they're different species or whether you lump or split?
Yeah, I think that's, because this is a species that was identified back in the 20s, it was, that's pre-genetics time. So it was all morphometric. It was like, measuring all the fin lengths and the eye size and all that. And now we're kind of reassessing a lot of those groups with the genetics. But, I think there is a lot of talk these days about restoring these deep water ciscos in the different lakes. So For the last decade or so, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has been catching bloater here in Lake Michigan, starting them off in a hatchery and then releasing them into Lake Ontario to kind of try to restart those bloater populations there. You know, also a lot of talk about Cisco's, you know, restoring Cisco's around the Great Lakes. So you have to understand, like, what is a species and then start the discussions of, you know, I think we've heard or I've heard, hey, maybe we should be maybe we could stock kai back into Lake Michigan. So, you know, where do you get those from? And, you know, those are kind of the questions that I think understanding if it's a species or not can be very useful for restoration.
Do they all serve as the same prey source for different predators, or do they like is like, so I saw that burbot like kai, but do they also like bloaters, or are they just focused on the kai?
Yeah, so that, you know, that's the question. I think, you know, it depends where you're at in the lake. So if I would tell the, you know, it's the food web story of Lake Superior, basically. So you know, kai are kind of the deep water. They're, you know, offshore, and that's where they're being eaten by burbot. They're being eaten by those Siskiwit lake trout, the really fat lake trout. Bloater are more of a shoreline, like near shore fish. So there's not a lot of overlap. And that's, you know, part of what these species have done. They've kind of filled in these different niches out in the Great Lakes. So kai are kind of this deep water, the middle of Lake Superior. And they're actually moving like up and down day and night, mainly feeding on the possum shrimp. They are, you know, then being eaten by those Siskiwit lake trout. And then in the closer to shore, that's where the bloaters are living. You might get some young kai swimming in. You could get some burbot eating both of those. And then the lean lake trout, kind of the lake trout you would go out fishing for, are also that kind of near shore. So, you know, I think what's neat about these deep water Siskos, like the kai, is how they've kind of filled in all these habitat and like feeding niches out in the lake. So
it's like Darwin's finches, but in Lake Superior, I guess.
Right? Exactly. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I mean, that's, I think they have been referred to as, you know, kind of analogous to Darwin's finches. You can look at lake trout as well as a, you know, a similar, like some of the forms of lake trout, which are still agreed to be the same species, but look very different. So, you know, really neat, really neat fish.
So why is it important to restore Cisco? So Cisco, help me understand. So they got kind of, not fully extirpated, but their populations went way down. And boy, this is in the, so I think listeners, I mention this every now and again, but I actually pay no attention to whatever whatever gets said on this show, because I'm so worried about the process of recording that I can barely do one thing at once. And so I just forget stuff. Like I had somebody reach out recently about an episode that they were on a year and a half ago or two. And I was like, I had to do some research to remember who they were, but it's fine. It's fine. That's just my own personal problem. So let's pretend that I don't remember the deal with Cisco for the fun of it. And I think it's probably vaguely related to salmon and Howard Tanner, who I do remember. So what's the deal with Cisco and why is it important to restore him?
Yeah. So, you know, when we talk Cisco restoration, that's mainly a discussion on kind of Lake Michigan, Lake Huron right now. Like that is historically, they were this really big fishery, really important part of the food web. So they were this food source for a lot of different, you know, predator fish. And I think the idea here, like when we look at Lake Michigan, Lake Huron, alewife numbers have declined. And, you know, maybe there is a space in these food webs for more Ciscos. And so state of Michigan has been stocking little Ciscos into Saginaw Bay for the last couple years, and they're putting a ton of them out there. And then they're going to see, you know, what happens with them. So, you know, it's, I think it's trying to create a food web that's, you know, sort of more natural, that's a good food source. Yeah. And Yeah. So
you think it'll work though? So the challenge of stocking, DNRs always want to stock. Well, I'm not, that's a broad brush to paint with, but when I was at Georgia, I was working on a imperiled species of sucker, and the DNR consistently wanted to stock them. And the broader point we're making is you can stock them all you want, but unless you want to do it every year, you need to sort of fix the fix whatever the issue is. Yeah. Yeah. And so maybe you do want to stock them every year. And stocking's great because it's a great outreach opportunity. It shows that you're doing something. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with it, but does it make sense to stock there? Do you have an opinion on that? Or are they doing something to sort of let's not talk about Michigan specifically. What do we need to do to get it so that stocking makes sense, I guess?
Yeah. You know, I think I support it. Stocking of Cisco, it is like it's an opportunity. I think it's an interesting, research angle too, to see, mm-hmm. you know, how they do. Are they going to, you know, succeed? Like ideally you want them to, you know, be able to stock them enough where they become, you know, self-sufficient populations. Mm-hmm. You know, Lake Superior has a big Cisco population. And it's also kind of very like they're whether or not they have good year classes, you know, these big kind of really successful years of a lot of baby fish, which we just apparently had one just in on the science from kind of last year report out was they saw a ton of Cisco all over Lake Superior, which is great news because it had been, you know, they're sort of like on decade scales where they have these huge booms and then, you know, they kind of don't always succeed in their kind of potential to produce these little fish. And, you know, maybe there's some climate parts to that. Maybe ice cover is a piece of that. It's, you know, a lot of questions about what's happening. So I think, you know, here we've got, you know, our Lake Michigan, Lake Huron food webs that are kind of, you know, lots of non-native invasive species in there. And maybe Cisco can kind of find their place and do well. Mm-hmm. And we'd have maybe more of a resilient food web.
Excellent.
So I have two questions. How deep is deep water? And okay, I was hoping you would answer that.
Or yes. Right away.
Yes.
Yes. Okay. So how deep? So
in fairness, you left you ended it kind of up like the second question was coming, right? It was like, how deep is deep water?
And right? Yes,
we're waiting for the end. All right.
Yeah. Well. So generally, near shore, that's the shallow water. That'd be out to about 100 meters or 30 meters. So about 100 feet, and then everything else is deep water.
Okay. So my second question is, how would this stocking work for these deep water Cisco? So they're being raised in something that's much shallower than that, right? Do they release them in the near shore area and they find their way to the deep water, or do they like go into the middle, like dump them and say good luck?
Yeah, so that, you know, and that would be the question. Like I think that is, those are the kinds of questions that that we would have to get answers to. You know, with a bloater. So bloaters are one of those deep water Cisco.
They're the name. Like
really. More of a it's a great name. It's bloaters. They come up in the nets, they're all bloated.
Yeah, but they want people to eat them. Like
that's they call them chubs, and people are like,
Wisconsin, ladies and gentlemen, Wisconsin. Sorry, I cut you off.
Yeah, so it's I think those are the questions. Like, and with a bloater, so bloaters are actually spawning in like February and, you know, 400 or 500 feet of water, but then in the spring, like those eggs hatch out and they actually come into shore. So, you know, there mm-hmm. could be, depending on when you stock these, so they might be coming into kind of shallower water at in a part of their first year, you know, taking advantage of that warmer water close to shore so they can kind of grow and feed. And then, you know, as they get bigger, they're going to go out to deeper water. But and like there's some fish species, like they've actually started stocking. They'll stock lake trout offshore. So like Fish and Wildlife Service has their big boat and they've got these tanks of fish on them. And they're actually like, putting them in. And I think part of that for bloater stocking in Lake Ontario, they've been trying that. And they're actually seeing that, they're stocking them off this boat. And then, I don't know, they're getting eaten or they're not even working, you know, doing that. So Yeah, lots
it's not
of
funny. This shouldn't be funny, but it's kind of funny.
It's a little bit funny. Well, we saw this. We saw the thing on Ask Dr. Fish, right? The plane. They use the planes for salmon stocking. Is that were those adults so that they're moving, or were they? No, it was juveniles.
Yeah, it was, that's yeah, just little kind of, you know, it's like stocking off a truck, off a boat, off a plane. It's all the same thing.
I'm going to toss this out there. Lake Superior, the second cleanest of the Great Lakes, beautiful out there behind Lake Michigan. We've had extensive conversations about this. sorry, Lake. So the thing
you said,
is,
you said clean. You should have said clear.
Clear.
It's,
you're
it's
right.
Not the cleanest. It's
that's
just
a clear. Solid point. Second clearest lake behind Lake Michigan, which is artificial. Well, not artificially, naturally clear in an artificial way, thanks to the mussels. But we have on here the lake lover herself, who is a scuba diver. I'm assuming extraordinaire. So I think you should give Megan. You should give Megan packs of. Kayai, you should just give her like a little suitcase of kayai, and she can dive them down into the depths.
Very slowly, will go down. Right. Which made me think. So these bloaters, do they get their names because they have the bins? Like they have all, they're being pulled up from these deep waters, and then they're bloated because all this nitrogen and gas is that's terrible.
Yeah, I mean it's their swim bladder because you know they're a deeper species, and uh-huh. So their swim bladder just expands.
Oh yeah, it's like the the snapper, like the reef fish in Florida.
Yep.
It does. It does. I mean, I'm when I go, I'll probably be a little bloated myself, but excellent. All right. So there are also a couple other lakey things. Now that we have you, so it didn't win, but so one of the enduring shames of this year's Lakeys is how Wisconsin heavy it was. We're embarrassed about this. We did not like it. But we are beholden to the submissions we get. So I don't know what kind of grassroots campaign y'all did over there.
It was lovely.
I assume it involved ballot stuffing. You were at grocery stores asking people if they had a minute for the environment or whatever. But
fill out the survey. Scan this QR code.
Yeah, exactly.
It was an all-hands-on-deck thing.
Yeah, I assume so. This is why Jim retired just to work on this. Yep. But anyway... You mentioned this fish. I'm interested in the fish row thing, right? Were you part of that at all?
I helped Sharon with it, but okay. Yeah, I'm kind of the, you know, she talks on the phone and I like fact check her basically.
Yeah. Okay. Well, what is the deal with that? So y'all convinced the whole nation of Sweden, was it, to eat fish eggs from Wisconsin. What is the background there?
Yeah, so like Scandinavia has, you know, they love their fish eggs over there. They love their tubes of fish eggs, yeah. And so they're kind of natural. You know, they have similar species over there. It's you know, also coregonids, and they, you know, have kind of overfished those. They don't really have the local sources, but Lake Superior's Cisco, those Artidae, are an acceptable substitute, and they really like them. And what had happened was WWF Europe, or I think, yeah, WWF Europe, the World Wildlife Federation, had kind of tentatively marked our Great Lakes fisheries as a void. And that would have, you know, there's a big their interest in sustainability over there. And, you know, it would have really affected our ability to export those eggs to Scandinavia and for them to import them and sell them. So, you know, and basically it was, they just didn't understand our management, how these fisheries are managed. And mm-hmm. They kind of said, hey, you know, avoid. And so that's where my colleague Sharon Moen came in. She was contacted by one of our producers over here who processes and exports a lot of that roe. And he was like, can you help? And so, you know, it was a pretty complicated process of Sharon talking to the folks over there, you know, connecting them with our managers, you know, providing all the data and explaining what it all meant. I think, you know, for them, they're kind of like somebody in Europe is like Googling Great Lakes fisheries and then, you know, can't understand how the management works and just says, well, I guess not managed well. And avoid. So, you know, basically she spent all this time,
right.
Explained it and they said, hey, this is actually a sustainably managed product and it's okay to import.
So a lot of this stuff, So, but y'all don't have like a certification. So what I talked about on there was how every time I go to IKEA, so our director, Thomas Hook, he is from Sweden. He was raised in Alabama, born in Sweden. And so he always asks me to pick up some of these toothpaste tubes of Callus caviar. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that wrong. In fact, I'm almost certain that I'm pronouncing it incorrectly. But I'm here, and they have these at IKEA, or he calls it IKEA. And so I go to IKEA, and this is a Swedish brand of smorgas caviar, of course. And you look at it. I'll put a link in the show notes to a picture. It's literally a toothpaste tube, and it's got this very Swedish-looking young man on it eating eating like a cracker with just rows of this on it and some sort of white spread, but it also has a certification logo, like Emma Marine Science or something. So have y'all done like a certification thing in Wisconsin, or did they not require that?
So the WWF is like, they do this certificate, you know, it's kind of like Seafood Watch, that the Monterey Bay Aquarium does. So they have like avoid, good alternative, and best choice. So it's sort of a ranking like that. It's not a certification. Like the certifications, you know, basically you're paying money to usually a third party to, like, you know, review this stuff and put a stamp on it, which kind of is what we did. Like, we provided WWF with the data so they could make a decision. We've been involved with the new kind of revisions for Seafood Watch as well, because, you know, we do have these really well-managed fisheries, but it's complicated because we have multiple states. We've got two countries. Okay. We've got the tribes, everybody working together, but it's not as easy as just saying, oh, I'll go to the NOAA fisheries and ask them for, you know, some ocean fishery where they all manage it the same. So, it's been, you know, we are kind of also looking at some of these third-party certifications, but, you know, that kind of complexity of our fisheries can make it hard too, because, you know, like, who would be certified, who would participate? Are we talking, you know, is this like Lake Superior's fisheries are certified, or is it just Wisconsin's?
Yeah, there's all the complexity, you
know, whitefish stuff, and like, who's going to pay for it too?
Yeah, that's the other thing, is the expense. We talk about a lot with aquaculture stuff is in order to undergo certification, you know, for the producers in Indiana and Illinois, you know, it wouldn't be worth it because it's too expensive. Yeah. So I also put a link into the show note to the Callus's main webpage, which I've gone to because I knew they made a vegan caviar. And so I wanted to send that in case Megan decided she wanted to try that.
I'm okay.
But once you go to the webpage, I don't know how to describe this. It is terrifying. On the top of the webpage, there is another very Swedish looking guy. He's got a toast full of caviar and
on eggs.
And he's got his mouth open with his tongue kind of protruding. He looks very fired up to eat it. But they have him moving, separated from the background of the photo, where some kid is about to hit him on the head with a pillow for unknown reasons. And he's moving toward the camera in a way that it can only be described as terrifying. Yeah.
He'll eat the caviar, then he'll eat you.
Yeah, he looks like, remember the Black Hole Sun video? I don't know if either of you was of that. He looks like he could be in the Black Hole Sun music video. Okay, so there's that. Now, anyway, so that's cool. Very neat that you've done that. Great service for everybody. And
thank you, Titus.
You know, I worry. We talk a lot, always with you, about eating fish, and I worry we over-index on eating fish. But it is a way. I mean, it's an industry. It's a way to sustainably use our natural resources. So I do get that. But for those who don't do it, I understand. And you can have this vegan Callus caviar. If you so want. But more important than all of this is this Kringle situation. So we had all kind of trouble with the Great Lakes Donut of the Year this year. It was a disastrous. It was all we had. Somebody nominated a cinnamon roll, a very large cinnamon roll. So they were not horking around with that. It was a very large cinnamon roll. But the thing is that it's not a donut, right? It doesn't have a torus shape. Not that donuts need to be toroid, I guess, because like a beignet, which is definitely a donut, but anyway, this cinnamon roll is clearly a cinnamon roll. It was frighteningly large, clearly a cinnamon. And then there was also the Kringles. My understanding, Titus, is that in addition to playing Kris Kringle, you're a Kringle eater. Tell me, what is a Kringle, man?
I can see you as Kris Kringle. That's awesome. I see it.
Yeah. Oh yeah, it was on a billboard. Didn't you listen to the Lakeys that you were on, Megan? Anyway,
no.
So what's the deal? What's the deal with Kringles?
She doesn't listen to when you talk, Stuart.
Who does?
Yeah, so Kringle. Kringle actually is our state pastry, maybe?
State pastry, your state
pastry. We do have, yeah, so Kringle. It's a Danish Kringle. It's basically this round Danish, generally kind of a big circle. Like, imagine an inner tube, but it's a Danish covered in frosting and, you know, filled with apple, cream cheese, whatever kind of thing. Yeah. So
not a donut, clearly, but good.
But the right shape. If you're really concerned about shape, having a hole in the middle, it's not bad. So
it does have that. Well, I don't know. We have to think about this more. We just trusted our audience, and that there was the key mistake.
See, that was your mistake. You can't trust your audience to especially know what a donut is.
Yeah, exactly. All right. But so the Kringle here, I don't have it open. It's Uncle Mike's. Yeah, I reached out to the Uncle Mike people. They wouldn't take my calls. I tried to get Uncle Mike himself on. I guess I've got other things to do. But you have had an Uncle Mike Kringle. Is this correct?
I have. You know, I'm going to say, like, Racine is Kringle Central, and Uncle Mike's is a De Pere Green Bay area based. For my money, they're a better Kringle, but... You know, that's the kind of thing that starts fights in Wisconsin.
No, we don't want to do that. But how big? So I looked to get an Uncle Mike Kringle because they'll ship them, but it's $38. Yeah. I assume a lot of that is because it's, you know, shipping fresh. You want to get it there quick. They have to overnight it or whatever because you don't want a 5-day old Kringle. No, exactly. Yeah. But what, how big is a Kringle? Like from Uncle, so if I'm going to order one, so what am I getting for my $38? That's what
Uncle Mike's, you're getting, you know, about 1,000 servings. It's you know, it is as big as your head. You could wear it as a hat and it would like, you know, come down probably over your ears.
Over your
ears. Yeah. And it's what Uncle Mike's has, they're very thick. So I've a thick Kringle. That. You go to O&H or one of those other brands that you might actually see in the store, which, you know, tend to be a lot thinner. You know, maybe an inch thick. So
not looking to it. Oh, they are big. It looks kind of like a pretzel almost. So it's got the little B shape, like a classic pretzel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Very cool. And so Kringle, worth going to Wisconsin for.
Absolutely. I mean, and you know, that salted caramel one, it's delicious. Kind of makes me sick when I eat it because I eat too much of it, but.
That's fair.
Yeah.
All right.
What's your second favorite then? If the sea salt caramel is your first favorite.
I got to go with the cheese from Uncle Mike's. It is, it's a very tasty filling. You know, it's all about the filling, I think, and the frosting on top. Yep. But the turtle one's good, too. Lots of ways to go.
Is it made with actual turtles, or is it?
Yeah, it's all snapping turtles, and it's delicious.
All right, well, enough of this. It's time for the Great Lakes News. And now it's time for the Great Lakes News. Here's your host, Stuart Carlton. Thank you for that, Stuart. Great Lakes News. We're bringing it back. It's been a while. We're going to have three Great Lakes News stories, and we're going to hear people talk about them. Story number one, the Great Lakes Fishing Decree is taking effect. They've re-ratified the Great Lakes Fishing Decree, and it recently took effect. Titus, what is the Great Lakes Fishing Decree?
Yeah, so also referred to as the Consent Decree. It's basically the agreement between the state of Michigan and the tribes about fishing in the Great Lakes for their tribal areas. So it's like a 20 year agreement. It says, you know, how much can be harvested, what gears can be used, where they can fish. And, you know, it took a lot of years to renegotiate. But now this one is in place.
It was approved by the U.S. District Court for the Western District of Michigan. Why is it there? And why do they get to say for, I guess, the whole Great Lakes area?
You know, it's related to treaties and, you know, treaty agreements. The first consent decree in 1985 was potentially court appointed.
Historical legal reasons.
Right? Yes. That's the way to say it.
So this has to do with fisheries management kind of throughout the area, though. What does the decree even say? Are you aware? Like, what kind of stuff is in there? Do you know?
Yeah. So, you know, because Michigan touches four of the lakes, it is treaty areas are on Lake Michigan for for the state of Michigan, Lake Huron and then Lake Superior. So it's kind of touching on all of those. Okay. You know, it seems like there was, you know, some new areas that these tribal commercial fishers could fish. And if you, in the story, they're, you know, kind of reminding people to be on the lookout for nets and kind of new areas. And yeah, so it's, you know, it's all about, you know, where people can fish and what they can fish for. And it's
super complicated. The Great Lakes, that's what it really brings to mind for me is, you know, we're dealing with two nations, different indigenous populations, which are also nations. And it shows you just something I didn't fully appreciate until I moved here, right? Just how complicated all of this is. And then doing right by, doing right by people who we displaced is really challenging too. Yeah. Story number two, smart buoys help brace Great Lakes for environmental challenges. So Lake Erie is the first of the Great Lakes getting connected with a series of smart buoys, which is going to be spreading kind of throughout, I think, the Great Lakes as they smarten the buoys. And so Lake Erie is kind of the first one that's part of this network. Megan, have you done you've done a lot of work with our buoys, right?
I have. Most of the work that I've done has been rescuing them. But I want to know why they're making the buoys in Lake Erie smarter and not our, like, the Lake Michigan ones smarter, or are Lake Michigan ones smart enough and then Lake Erie's are less superior than them?
That's a good question. Titus, how smart are buoys and what does this mean exactly in terms of data in the Great Lakes?
Yeah, I think this is... I think Lake Erie is kind of the test bed here for this, you know, newer technology and maybe being more interconnected between the buoys. And, you know, I think we can look forward to seeing smarter buoys. I think our buoys are still pretty smart. You know, you can go onto the website, you can look at the data. So, you know, that's pretty awesome. But, you know, I think what they're doing here, you know, they're looking at the newer technology and, you know, maybe it's more smaller buoys that are kind of interconnected and, you know, doing some really cool stuff.
Oh, will smaller buoys survive the wave action that are in the lakes?
Well, remember, Chewy is a smaller buoy. Chewy, our newest buoy, it's smaller too. And it's a, yeah. And Chewy hasn't been hit yet by Chicago, but it's a good question. This is this is Freeboard Technology, which is run by Ed Verhamy, who is one of our partners and former Teach Me About the Great Lakes guest. Anyway, so yeah, no, it's interesting to see. Titus, do you use buoy data a lot? Is that something that comes up?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're I'm in kind of this area that hasn't had a lot of buoys in the past, and now that we have a National Marine Sanctuary, they're actually putting in some buoys. They're partnering with UW Milwaukee to upgrade one to be, you know, more of a you know, weather plus other things. Right now they just have kind of a, you know, these small buoys that can measure simulated wave height, you know, approximate wave height, and then they have some strings of temperature loggers that go down to the bottom. So you know, I think those are kind of smaller buoys, you know, more affordable. And, you know, potentially interesting, definitely hearing from our anglers around the area, you know, using this data. And, you know, so they have, you know, boating uses and, you know, pretty neat to see.
That data is important. That's one point I want to make. Like, that's, I mean, the big theme of this show is you know, Teach Me About the Great Lakes overall is the importance of data, the importance of monitoring. Mm-hmm. And if governments don't tend to do that, then it doesn't tend to get done. And it's really valuable in the long run. So that is good. Story number three. Once they were pets, now giant goldfish are menacing the Great Lakes. And so the story here is that people have been releasing. What's that? Maybe is that? I don't know. Hello.
Hey, Teach Me About the Great Lakes crew. Tim Campbell.
Wow, Tim, about AIS, and instantly, Tim appears out of nowhere. Tim, so you must have sensed a disturbance in the force, as it were.
The invasive species signal popped up on my wall over here, so I knew I had to call it.
Shape of a goldfish, so yeah. I knew the species, too.
You know, that was excellent. So, Tim, tell us about goldfish. I guess goldfish, so people have been releasing pets, I guess, into the Great Lakes, and now they're tracking them. What is the deal with goldfish in the Great Lakes, Tim?
So I think we could just generally talk about pets in general. When people I mean, with all sorts of pets, when people have some difficulty caring for their pet, they can't take care of it any longer. They maybe try to find it a new home, you know, whatever. That's just really hard. And it gets harder with kind of the more exotic or less furry your pet is, right? So like dogs and cats, pretty easy to find a new home for. But when you start talking about fish, it's just tough to find a new home for things. And so what can happen is that the easiest thing for somebody to do is to let their pet go. And they can start, you know, convincing themselves that Fluffy the goldfish is going to have a better life out in Lake Ontario than they would somewhere else, right? And so releasing goldfish and pets in general has been a problem for a while. It's something we've been working to address through the Great Lakes Sea Grant Network. But what's cool about this new paper in the Journal of Great Lakes Research is that they actually tracked a population of goldfish to try to understand their behaviors.
And so we're gonna actually interview one of the authors of that paper coming up in a future episode. But so they're carp, is that right? So this is we've been keeping our eye on the wrong invasive carp, I guess.
Yeah, I might defer to an actual Dr. Fish for some better detail on this. But yeah, they're closely related to Prussian carp and Crucian carp. So, you know, they're generally small fish, although they can get, you know, pretty big, especially for a goldfish.
And they will hybridize with common carp as well. So, you know, they're closely enough related. They can do that.
Yeah. And I tend to think that they have the same kind of general impacts. They root around for vegetation. They can now compete native species for food and space and just become really abundant.
So Titus, are you you're a fish guy. Do you have an aquarium full of goldfish or are you a native fish? What kind of fish do you have in your aquarium, Titus? That's what I'm asking.
Seward, I don't have an aquarium. The Great Lakes are my aquarium. That's where I go to.
Love it.
It's where I go to. You know, I think this story is interesting. I actually, where is it? Like, you can't see it on the, see it because you're listening, but there's my PhD diploma from McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario, where this study was from. And they were talking about the fishway, and that was actually, there's this Coots Paradise Marsh, which was right adjacent to our campus. And, you know, this was 22 years ago when I started at McMaster, and the fishway was in place then. It was really for common carp. They were trying to remove the common carp and basically sort all the fish, keeping carp out, and I guess now goldfish as well. So, you know, kind of a neat long-term management of this species to try to control it.
I think where one of the problems is people think that Fluffy, this like 2-3 inch goldfish, is going to like live in this big old lake being small, but they expand, right? They get massive.
I mean, the one in the article, I'll put the link in the show notes. Talk about a bloater. Look at this thing. Yeah. But no, it's true. Is people don't think about, right? They're like, oh, what difference can one fish make, right?
Yeah.
And so I think that's a good point.
The only goldfish I ever caught was in Lake Ontario. It was,
you caught it?
Well, in my research, it was closer to Toronto. I think it was the Credit River Marsh, but it wasn't this orange. It was more of a, you know, kind of a golden color that you'd see with a common carp, but definitely, you know, very round and definitely not a common carp.
Hmm. Well, then, so Tim, rather than throw them into the lake where they become invasive carp, what are some options for people with goldfish or other fish pets, maybe even crustaceans or things like that they have as pets? What are some other options for what people should do with them?
Yep. So pet owners have a lot of good options, especially here in the Great Lakes region, for pets they can no longer care for. The Habitattitude program, the Be a Hero, Release Zero program, run by, you know, different Sea Grant programs here in the Great Lakes, have a good checklist of things that pet owners can do before, you know, they're left with no other options. And so kind of the easiest thing you can do is just check with your friends. You probably have a friend or somebody in your social network that would love to take care of your pet. If that doesn't work, you can check with a store. A lot of independent pet retailers have networks of people that are willing to rehome kind of pets that people can no longer care for. So it's always worth checking there. And then more and more nonprofits are popping up that kind of specialize in rehoming different pet species. We work with one in Wisconsin, JNR aquatic animal rescue, and they can help rehome aquatic pets pretty much anywhere in the state. I think they host 20 different events a year. Different aquarium societies also have rehoming networks. And if you're left with no other options, you can always check with your local veterinarian, and they might have some ideas too.
I wonder if like schools, like K through 12 schools, would be open to putting them in their classrooms. Like, that seems a really great way to have them live another life with all kinds of different people looking at them and not tapping on the glass.
Yeah. Reach out to your Sea Grant educator. They might be able to help hook you up.
And that's a great idea. And it's something when on like previously funded organisms and trades projects, we discuss those things. And I think it just takes a motivated Sea Grant education or AIS specialist to try to help facilitate some of those things.
And it seems like at the end of the school year, where do those go? Because as the recipient of 3 crayfish 1 year at the end of the school year, you know, they may just end up in another home, but maybe it's a summer residency for these goldfish, and they can go back to the classroom.
Yeah, go to Maine. Excellent. Well, that's I think the awareness thing is important, right? Because I think people just don't think about it. It's exactly what you said, Megan. They think they're putting this little goldfish in there, and they don't know that one day Fluffy is going to be the size of a Uncle Mike's Kringle. And
and I think people also think too that this fish is going to have a better life out wherever they release it. And most of the time, it doesn't. It gets eaten by something. It's not equipped to survive. And then if it does survive, it becomes invasive. So it's got a not great either way.
Not a great life. All right. But Tim, now that you're here, we got other things to talk about. All right. Great Lakes News is over. Bloop, bloop. Thank you. Glad to have the segment back. We'll do it again sometime. But we've already asked both y'all so many times about your sandwiches and your donuts and your special places because y'all are periodic guests. So instead of that, we're going to go straight to sandwich talk here. Tim, as you know, listeners, because you listened to our last or the episode a couple weeks ago with the Lakeys, Tim is the first ever Lakey loser because he sent us a picture of this monstrosity. He nominated this. He tried to do it anonymously, but I assume out of shame. And and he tried to do that, and he sent in this picture of this thing, but it was at a Google Drive that had his name on it. So I, of course, as a person of integrity, called him out on this. And so what is this thing, Tim? I'll put a link in the show note. I'm trying to find the link right here. Here it is. What is this, Tim? And where did you have it?
First, I would like to stand behind my sandwich choices and again, adventurous eating. So it was good. I don't think I'd ever eat it again because I feel all like right. There are simpler ways to achieve this effect, but what it is,
let's describe it so that the listener doesn't know what it, if they're not, you know, they're driving, so hopefully they haven't clicked on the show notes, so they haven't clicked on this image, and if they were driving and clicked on it, they have crashed and died out of heart. Describe this thing to us, please.
So I'm going to paint a delicious picture for you, listener. So just, it's a standard hot dog, right? Standard bun, nothing too exciting. But there is macaroni and cheese on it, like standard yellow mac and cheese, and Fruit Loops. My thing is when I go to a baseball game, I like to try to find the weirdest thing to eat at the ballpark. And at the Cleveland Guardians ballpark, where I was during Sea Grant week, this was the weirdest thing at the ballpark. So decided to try it out.
Yeah, I was there. Hey, wait, which game did you go to? Was it the one where both managers got thrown out on one play?
I don't know. We might have been a different game. I don't remember that.
No, they had another homestand. I was at that thing. But yeah, no, I don't.
We should coordinate on baseball game attendance, though.
Yeah, there was a big argument, and both managers got thrown out on the single. It was the greatest sporting event I've seen in my whole life, maybe up until I just saw Caitlin Clark.
They were actually arguing about this hot dog.
Yeah.
Yes. It really was.
I'll put a link in the show notes to the argument if we keep it in, although it's kind of profane. Okay, so you're at the game. Yeah, it was the Sea Grant week. I was at a baseball game, too. It's super fun to see the Guardians versus the Angels back when they had Shohei Ohtani. Anyway, the point is this. You decide to order this disgusting thing. What was it called, and can you describe the taste? Because it seems there's a lot of textures going on, a lot of flavors going on. Yeah.
You know, honestly, I don't remember the name of it. Okay. If it's helpful, I could Google it really fast.
No, that's okay. Right? I think you know.
No one needs to know the name.
It's notable that it erased from your mind, right?
Yeah, and my guess is that it only existed for one season.
Oh, good.
But yeah, Like, it was a cheesy hot dog with some crunch on it, but instead of it being like a salty crunch, it was a sweet crunch, right? Which, I mean, I've had a hot dog before with some cheese on it and like some fried onions.
Yeah.
So it felt kind of like that, except...
Right, but it's Fruit Loops.
Fruit Loops and mac, like, unnecessarily over the top. But, you know, I'm happy I did it, right? Like, it was an experience.
The sweet and savory mix was perfect.
Yes.
Well, you know what? Next time I go to a Guardians game, I am relatively certain that I will not get that.
Can I recommend, though, the barbecue pork and coleslaw waffle cone? That was delicious. So do that one.
I don't eat meat, and that does sound good.
Well, there we go. There is our Lakey's follow-up. Tim, if people want to find out more about what you're eating or what you're doing, where should they go?
I guess Twitter? I don't know. Nowhere. I don't really post there anymore.
All right.
Know. LinkedIn?
Yeah.
Don't post there either. So.
Yeah. All right.
Send me an email.
Send Tim an email. Yeah. You'll look it up yourself. I'm not going to say it out loud. Yeah. Titus, you're still fairly active. Where can people go? I mean, in addition, we've asked Dr. Fish. AskDrFish.com. Where else can they go to find out more about what you're doing?
Yeah, I mean, you can follow me at Dr. Fish SG at whatever social you're interested in, if that's okay. Instagram or Blue Sky. I got some videos on YouTube. And hey, send me an email at Wisconsin Sea Grant.
Fantastic. All right.
Teach Me About the Great Lakes is brought to you by the fine people at Illinois Indiana Sea Grant. We encourage you to check out the cool stuff we do at IICGrant.org and at ILINC Grant on Facebook, Twitter, and other social media.
Our senior producer is Carolyn Foley, and Teach Me About the Great Lakes is produced by Megan Gunn and Renee Miles. Ethan Chitty is our associate producer and fixer. Our super fun podcast artwork is by Joel Davenport, and the show is edited by the amazing Sandra Swoboda. Welcome, Sandy. Thank you so much, assuming the paperwork goes through.
If you have a question or comment about this show, please email it to Teach Me About the Great Lakes or leave a message on our hotline at 765-496-IISG or 4474. You can also follow the show on Twitter at Teach Great Lakes, but like lakes themselves, really, what's the point? Thanks for listening and keep creating those lakes.